these things. Hello, welcome back, everybody and everybody, and even to the charmingly disembodied. This is the Integral Stages Meta Podcast, where we podcast podcasters, broadcast broadcasters, and generally explore the space of people trying to use emerging tools to bring forth higher, deeper, and more transformative ways of being in the world. I'm Layman Pascal, and today we're here with the co-hosts of the new Radical Emergence podcast, Dr. Sally and Dr. Jen. Hello, ladies.
Hi, Layman.
Good to be with you both.
I was told, and I'm not sure if this is true, that there's a 100% guarantee of personal transformation for listeners to this podcast. Is that correct?
That is correct. And yes, everybody will be transformed just by listening to one podcast. No, I'm just kidding.
It's much like that wafer that you might eat in church, Layman. You just need a wafer and a sip of wine and you'll be transfigured. This is what the podcast can do for you.
Symbolic transmutation. I love it. Where are you both? What place in the world are you each?
You go ahead, Jen.
I'm in Atlanta.
And I'm on Vancouver Island off the west coast of Canada.
I know it well. For people who are listening, there are links that go along with this podcast. The first podcast of Radical Emergence contains a lot of personal information about Sally and Jen. So I'm going to take autobiography as a given and jump right into the arcane edges of my own curiosity. And the first thing that came up for me is, why radical? How is radical emergence different from just regular emergence?
You start, Jen. Go ahead.
Well, what isn't radical about transformation? That's, you know, I think transformation is a miraculous, radical process. And I can't think of a better word to describe this field of transformation that we live in, that we exist in, that's transforming us and how we're being transformed. Just felt like a good fit. The word felt like a good fit, going to the roots of radish and being at the roots of transformation felt like the point we wanted to hit with the show. What do you think, Sally?
Yeah, I think it's radical in a number of ways, actually. Number one, it's a team of women speaking about integral, and we've had a couple of elders who've done that, but it's not common. And so we felt that we needed to role model, that women need to be speaking up. And so presenting their perspective, so in a small way, that's fairly radical still. And what I mean by the feminine perspective is that it includes descending. It includes pain. It includes suffering. It includes feeling the body. So in that way, it's very radical still in terms of transformative teachings. It's not about just doing the ascending and the enlightenment. It's also about approaching the void, because that's more realistic on the ground. People want to know about suffering because suffering's on the increase. So even just using that word suffering in the enlightenment teachings business, that's radical. We're not going to bypass pain.
What's the difference between pain and suffering?
Yeah, that's a great question, Layman, because it's on everybody's mind right now as existential anxiety increases, as a recession is coming. We want to stay really practical and really reach people on the ground. We don't want to be talking in our little bubble anymore with elitist academic language. So that's another radical thing, is we're using language to bridge the gap to people who've never heard of integral or metamodernism. And so when you talk about pain and suffering, we're just trying to be grounded, reach people who are really going through a hard time right now. And for them, pain and suffering can feel like the same thing. So when we talk about radical emergence, we're going to be addressing teachings that separate those two out so that we can understand, number one, identity. If we're identifying with our pain, we're truly going to suffer. If we have a limited identity. So we're going to be talking about difficult concepts, because maybe some of these concepts are new to folks who are not in our little bubble and our circle. So we want to reach people who've never even considered the word identity, or the fact that pleasure and pain are kind of the common guides we have, and that transformation can come through either of those avenues. and in the end, you welcome all of them as your teacher. Those concepts are radical for most people. Working with your pain so that you're not suffering, as opposed to avoiding your pain so that you're creating more and more suffering. That's a radical concept for most folks. What do you think, Jen?
Yeah, I agree with all of that. And I would say, before I started coming into relationship with myself and started doing self-inquiry and I had a radical awakening, I really suffered. I suffered in my mind. I suffered greatly because I wasn't in relationship with my mind. I didn't have any kind of self-awareness on the inside to speak of. And as I've come online as a conscious person, doing that radical self-inquiry, finding myself, I start to recognize that pain exists. Pain is part of life. You can't get away from it. It's just part of the condition that we seem to be living in this world. But as I have a relationship with myself, I realize I don't have to suffer from that pain in my mind because I can be a conscious person and be aware of it. And, you know, so if I'm in pain in my body, which I experience a lot of pain in my physical body. So a lot of my practice is very, it's very practical on the ground, living with pain. And I can either suffer from that by not being in relationship with my body, and then my body suffers more, or I can be in conscious relationship with myself and have a relationship with that suffering so that I'm not suffering from it. So there is a subtle difference there. And we touch on that in our podcast. We try to really lean into the subtleties and complexities that we're talking about here in terms of, living a conscious life.
You know, Layman, I'd like to just add that in a lot of our circles that actually do believe in developmental hierarchies, because we've had conversations recently where people dismiss that, but we're coming from that aspect. We do believe in developmentalism. But what is not spoken about in our circles is that each time you transition, it's radically turbulent. This is not fun. So that's never spoken about. So that's another radical aspect for Jen and I, is that we've noticed with our own transitions, it's always been a dark night of the soul. So until you can begin to see that pattern as normal and begin to work with that, you can't really cooperate with your growth. You keep resisting it because sometimes it's painful. So, yeah, we also talk about the blockages and the traumas and how we can accidentally prevent our development, which is never spoken about in our circles either.
One of the things that I love is when we start out the program, I think it was the last episode, we were talking about how turbulence is goes back to the beginning of time, from the Big Bang. We're talking about major transformations in the universe that were very violent and disturbing. And we're all experiencing that, in our own microcosm of the macrocosm. And so if we can start to invite that, like Sally's saying, and we can start to say, oh yes, I'm living in this turbulent field of transformation. And right now I'm way up here, but at some point I'm going to be here, and expect that kind of oscillation in the transformative wheel, then it becomes easier. Then we're moving with transformation as opposed to against it.
That's really interesting to me because lately I've been in some discussions about different processing styles where it seems like some people want to move forward by having a kind of balanced perspective at every step of their journey. And other people like to sort of completely believe each step and go through a bunch of steps and then balance all of that out. So, are there people for whom it is better to, when you're high in the transformation process, remember that you soon will be low, and kind of take a slightly standoffish perspective about the oscillations of the affect, and other people for whom it's actually better for them to kind of totally believe that the step that they're in is already complete and total, and then be surprised by the next step and believe that one's complete and total?
Yeah, Layman, I think that folks that are attracted to transformation and the various forms of it, because one of the things we're going to do is look at Eastern and Western models, just not just spiral dynamics or Wilburism. So we're trying to be culturally inclusive. And if we do that, one of the things we'll notice is that people who are attracted to developmental models of any kind, whether they're Chinese, Indian, American, is that we love patterns. And that's beautiful about us. We love to look at patterns and maps and try to organize information. That's a sign of developmental in our cognitive line. That's great. So given that we love patterns, Jane and I are going to talk about quite a few different patterns, some of which are linear, some of which are rhizomatic, some of which are binaries. Jane and I have a great feeling together for that paradox pattern that we integrate opposites. So paradox in terms of two parts coming together to make a whole, the holonic nature of development. And that's one of the patterns we love, but we're not going to just stick to linear spiral dynamics patterns. Because in my own personal experience, I shot to green and had to go back to orange heavily, heavy duty reversal. And I've noticed that I'm an uneven developer. Parts of me shoot forward and then I have to go back and reintegrate. So I personally don't believe in the linearity of that pattern, but I love the look of it. The visual linearity of it is beautiful, but on the ground, it's not necessarily like that. So yeah, we love patterns, and that's how we understand reality, is through symbols.
That's how right. Did you two meet, and how did you decide that you could do a podcast together?
You go ahead, Jen.
We met in the Metamodern Spirituality group. I was participating in that group for a period of time, and just brief enough time really to meet Sally. And I was just involved in other projects and doing other things, but we made a connection right away. I really admire Sally on all levels. I've never really met somebody who speaks to my bones in the way that Sally does. I'm not much of a, you know, I'm not into gurus and teachers. I've been a solo practitioner most of my life. But I felt an instant resonance and trust with Sally. And I knew that we would do something. It took some time for us to kind of figure out in talking about what, you know, what, how our relationship would be, what project we would do. But when we thought about podcasts, and you know, both of us are enamored by transformation on all levels, intellectual, lived experience. That's so, to have that resonance with somebody, I feel is, you know, rare. And we realize that it's rare for two people to come together with our unique lived experience, with our scholarly experience, our scholarly knowledge, all of it brought together would create some kind of synthesis. And we're now experiencing that synthesis. We didn't even know, you know, how it was even going to roll out, but we trust it. And we're still, you know, we're in that process now. It's being born and we trust it. And it's, so it's beautiful to collaborate with like-minded people. And I just feel really lucky to know and love Sally and be doing this project. And I have no doubt this is the first of many projects we will work on together.
Yeah, I'd love to answer that. Thank you for that question, Layman, because I feel this is the way forward, is to start co-creating together, all of us somehow, and find that right partner. And that's such a gift when you do. It's so much easier to bounce ideas off people and feel that resonance. And it just gives you the energy to start creating. We have to start creating and not just speaking in our bubble. So Jen approached me and we started talking, and quite frankly, I'm just blown away by Jen. She has been through so much. She is such a survivor that I have infinite respect, not only for the fact that she's lived transformation, so she's speaking from an authentic embodied realization, but then she also went and did the academic stuff. And who on earth does PhDs in transformation? She and I are the only ones that I actually know of. There might be others out there. I'd love to hear from any listeners who are that geeky, as Jen and I are, that we actually went through so much transformation ourselves, we then had to academically understand what happened. And now our job is to bridge between academia and people on the ground. And she and I both have that motivation, is to just drop the academic shit. We've got that handled. We're bridges. We're going to speak the common language and somehow try and reach folks, because they just think we're a bunch of assholes. I'm going to be frank. We're a bunch of elitists that they can't even access. The language has got ridiculously, you know, it alienates people. So I guess when Jen and I discovered that we both want to do this reversal move of translation, of bridging, we just went, wow, this is like the dream team. And I'm absolutely thrilled. Jen and I work together so fluidly that it's not even work, it's play. And we both feel like this is our lifetime's culmination of what we've spent decades trying to understand physically, mentally, and cognitively, you know, just on every level. And Jen brings slightly different stuff. She has done academic work in eco-psychology, and we feel that's critical, is that we no longer just talk about personal transformation. Some of our communities talk about transformation as couples, like Martin Jucic. Some of us speak about trying to bridge the Atlantic between the Nordic metamoderns and the American metamoderns. And so this synaptic convergence is beginning to be really critical. And Jen brings that eco-awareness of the fact that it's a whole field of transformation. So that's what we're trying to articulate. And I bring other stuff to the table that Jen doesn't bring. So we're a dream team. So we have also a yin-yang thing going on. When we speak, we've noticed that. Like I'm the yang of the team and Jen's the yin. And so I think that's a very beautiful current in any team as well, is bringing those two things together.
There's something in what you just said that brought up a phrase I heard in one of the podcasts that I wanted to ask about. And Jen, what the hell is transpersonal eco-psychology?
Great question. Well, transpersonal, you know, is just beyond the personal psychology, right? It's a large field. And eco-psychology is the study of the relationship between the mind and nature, and, you know, why we humans are the way we are to our earth home and to our animal kinfolk. And it's a study of our biophilia, which is natural, our love of nature, as much as our madness with our unsustainable behavior. We're facing multiple systems collapse. And so eco-psychology is interested in looking at those things. And I graduated from Naropa University, and it was really that was another transformative experience in my life, that awakening too. I had had an awakening in nature, and that really drove me to understand that I wanted to understand what happened to me. And, you know, when I lost my mind that the trees were talking to me, but, you know, then I backed that up with some, you know, intellectual knowledge that in fact, you know, we are communicating with nature all the time and nature's communicating with us all the time. So yeah, eco-psychology is a beautiful field. Not a lot of people have been exposed to it, but I hope to change that as well.
I really resonate with a lot of that. I'm a big fan of Gurdjieff, and one of the least trumpeted aspects of his work is about an ecological framing of human transformation, that our change works in tandem with, or might even be considered a side effect of, our fulfilling a purpose in the biosphere, somewhat analogous to the role that an organ might play in a body. I wonder if there's more you could say about the significance of ecology and biospheres to the processes of creative transformation in the human organism. To what degree does our transformation, is it required for the biosphere? And to what degree is a change in our relationship with the biosphere required for our benign transformations?
Beautiful. Perfect. Well, that we just did our third show on the fractal relationship between our inner world and outer world. And one of the most profound changes for me was that when I had this huge inner awakening, it led to real positive behavioral shifts that have significant impact on how I live in the world and how I live with our earth home and how I live with animals and You know, my diet changed because I was exposed to information about the animal industrial complex and how horrific that is. So our inner transformation has everything to do with our ecological transformation. If we're going to get ourselves together on an ecological level, it's going to happen from within first. And we're going to have awakenings, you know, one by one, where we start to take seriously our relationship with nature and with other animals. And we can't do that if we're all, you know, in the hypnotic haze of, you know, business as usual, as Joanna Macy calls it, right? If we're just, you know, have our heads in the sand, we've got to wake up and in time to really save ourselves. So this is why I feel like the field of eco-psychology is so important. Sharing this message is so important because it's really, I think, one of the overlooked keys to our success as a species on this planet, because, you know, the planet's going to go on, you know, with or without us. And we are at a point where we can make some decisions to change, but it's going to happen first within. So on our show, we look at those three lenses and we never forget that ecological lens. Our eyes always steady on that ecological lens of transformation.
Yeah, I'd love to add to that, Jen, too, that that's part of becoming cosmocentric. So unless we're having those conversations and normalize those concepts, the move to cosmocentric is critical to see the planet as a whole organism without getting into Gaia theory. Yeah, but also it's an imaginative leap into extended empathy. So we actually need to imagine the sentience of other living organisms so that we can be less violent. So there's a radical leap in empathy that's needed. Yeah, and we get lost down this rabbit hole of sitting on our cushion and doing meditative masturbation without turning to action. And so we're hoping that some of this awareness will translate into action. It's time for action.
The notion of being horrified by what's going on in the animal industrial complex makes me think of negative goads to transformation. Then there's also positive goads. John Verveke talks a lot about kratia and sofrasin, about the struggle against the negative versus being seduced by the positive. What are some of the patterns that you see in terms of mediating between transformation as something we're pulled toward and transformation as something we try to use as an escape from something that's awful in the world that needs to be changed? Where are the positive and negative poles on this, and what sort of variations do you guys see?
Yeah, so I think, you know, we do really need to notice that many of us are on overload right now, just watching the news, and especially young folks are getting this unbelievable despair about the future. So it's not like we don't need to protect ourselves. We do, and we need to be very selective about this information overload. So we do need to be open to change, at the same time protect our capacity and be aware of how much we can handle at any given moment. Otherwise, we do just turn to the cushion and hide. And that's just a way of taking care of ourselves. But coming out of that deliberately is important, so that we notice that merge and emerge, those two actions, the masculine and the feminine, the go into the true self, sit there and find your highest emotional state, and then come out and take some action. So Jen and I always return to the paradox. It's never one or the other, it's both. So I highly recommend going to the cushion and taking care of yourself. And then I highly recommend coming out of there with renewed vigor and taking action. So for Jen and I, transformation starts with the self. So it's really important, but then it has to resonate into the field. It has to have these increased circles of care and sentience and awareness. So both of those, the emerge and the merge, are critical understandings. In fact, that's one of our episodes.
Beautiful. I love that. And I would say that one of the reason identity is so important is because one of the ways identity shifts is that I am an individual, but I'm also nature, right? So my desire to be kind to other animals, to be kind to our earth home, to be sustainable, that's not arising because I see those things as objects that are outside of me that need me to help them, right? It's my decisions are being driven because I am part of their lives and they are part of me. And there's an instinctual connection there between us that is real. And it's not always, I'm vegan. It's not always easy to be vegan in the world. Try traveling, you know, there's a lot of things that get in the way of that. But when it's hard, it's easier because I'm not doing it just for me. I'm doing it because I'm not interested in supporting that system that is abusive to animals, right? So what's driving that behavior is love, is connection. And it, so it doesn't feel like work, you know, it doesn't feel like, oh, I have to, you know, I'm losing something. It's a gaining of a whole universe of connection. So I think coming from a place of that shared destiny, of that shared field of transformation, those, you know, animals are a field of transformation that we are interacting with. Nature is a field of transformation that we are interacting with. And the more we interact within that field from that place of oneness and connection, the kinder the world is going to be and the better chance we have of saving ourselves.
Yeah, and could I add that move from narcissism then steps into a kind of centering of the human story, the anthropomorphization of everything, and it's just us, and then that movement beyond that. So we're looking at moving from centering the self, centering the human in the grand narrative, and now the new story has to center the interdependence of all of life.
When I think about everything, all identities being fields of transformation, it sounds simultaneously exciting and exhausting. When do I get to not be transforming? Do I get a break from this process?
Layman, I've been begging for one of those from the universe my whole life. Please just give me a 10-minute break. I just need a break to reintegrate and rest. I don't know. I can't answer that.
Yeah, everything in your body is transforming. Every minute, you know, you have transformative experiences happening on a cellular level. You know, your skin is falling off. You're growing new skin cells. And that's a constant process. But I think transformation, if you come at it from a perspective of, you know, oh, this is work. This is something I have to do. It can be very exhausting. But when you can come at it with, oh, I'm just a transformative being and I'm in this flow of transformation that's always happening, that will always be happening, it gets a little bit easier to ride that wave than feeling like you have to, you know, stay up on your surfboard all the time and ride the waves of transformation just right. Don't fall off, you know. No, yeah, sometimes you fall. Sometimes you surf. Sometimes the waves are good. Sometimes they're shit. You know, it's, you know, I think coming at it as being part of a field, a flow, as opposed to something you're doing, maybe takes the pressure off a little bit.
Yeah, I think we've noticed over our lives, Layman, that actually it's the resistance and the avoidance that takes more energy. So when we're exhausted, it's like, okay, we do want to run and hide. And as I said, we need to protect ourselves to recover from these waves, transformative waves. They kind of come in a movement. So cooperating with flow, not only of your inner flow, but the flow of your life and the flow of the whole field at the moment takes care, but resisting it takes more energy. It's like if you thought of a wire with a knot in it that gets hot and eventually explodes, the ohms are just too much. So literally one of the skills for surviving our moment is understanding how the nervous system works. So that's the other radical part of our conversation, is we're bringing it fully into the body and how to survive this moment by working with our fight, flight, and our rest, digest. It's the only way we're going to do it.
Seems like there's a couple of different ways that breakdown and breakthrough can be thought of. On the one hand, you can think of them as alternatives, as different kinds of phenomenon. You can think of them as phenomenon where, on the one hand, someone's prepared, and then it's a breakthrough, or they're not prepared, they're resisting, and it's a breakdown. But you might also think, as you two, I think, already alluded to, that there's a deep entanglement of these processes. And sometimes transformation oscillates between them, or there might be things where you can't really tell what's a breakthrough and what's a breakdown. How do we adjudicate between breakthrough and breakdown when there's so many variations of the relationships between them?
I want to jump into that one. It's one of my favorites because it's about creativity, which is the one aspect I can bring to Jen in my conversation. This nature of the two arrows, the entropy as well as the eros. Most of our conversations in our liminal web are a lot to do with eros and the construction project of the universe, which is awesome. That's about emergence. Even the name emergence is used all the time. And even the language denies 50% of what's going on. For anything to be built, it has to be reconstructed over and over again. That's evolution, is a reiteration project through mutation and adaptation. But if you look at that journey, it has to be 50% destruction all the way along. The reassembly plant of our highest forms takes branches of evolution dying. It takes branches of us. And so we describe what that feels like in the body. It's not fun. You can have suicidal ideation at times because you realize on a subconscious level that something is dying. It's the parts of you that are no longer functioning, the illusions that create suffering. All the limitations have to die. There's entropy all along the way of any building project of evolution. So we bring in that paradox all the time that we have to include entropy. That's another radical thing to be doing these days because it's exhausting, as you said, and it creates anxiety and all the things. Jen, what do you say about that?
Well, the boundary lines between breakthrough and breakdown and breakthrough are murky, and you know, it gets super entangled. You know, every breakthrough I've had has major breakthrough I've had has come through a breakdown of some kind, typically of, you know, things not going in the direction I think and or how I expect them to go. Or, you know, sometimes there's an intuitive sense that the breakdown is needed. And so you're walking kind of towards it, you're courting it, even maybe even subconsciously, you're like, maybe doing some self-sabotage because you know that there's maybe some breakthrough energy in that breakdown, right? So this is very subtle work we're doing on the inside. And I don't think that there's an easy map to say, oh, yep, that's a breakdown and that's a breakthrough. It's really messy. It's individual for every person. That's why, you know, having that conscious relationship with yourself is so necessary. Because what somebody else's breakdown looks like might be your breakthrough, right? And so you that being in that self, having that self-awareness allows you to sort of intuit, you know, where you are in that process, that transformative arc. But even that is, you know, uncertain. You know, so much of a breakdown is in uncertainty and loss and unknowing. And then suddenly there's an emerges a perspective and you're in a breakthrough and you're like, wow, yeah, I mean, everything fell apart as I expected it. And suddenly I'm in this new place and it's even better than I could have ever imagined. Right. Or, you know, I've had years and years of breakdown, you know, just constant decades of breakdown in my life. And yet the sun rose. Eventually, right? So it's just important. I think that's why the job we're doing on the podcast is so important, to describe this as a process without an ending and without a beginning that started the moment we were born and that will continue after we die in some way we don't know how. Yeah.
Is this a process that we're just subjected to, or is it something we can facilitate and participate in? Like if someone's feeling themselves in a breakdown, a decay, a death mode, what are some strategies they could use to help them move through that more effectively? Or is there no way to methodologically help yourself through that and you just are carried along?
Yeah, this is really important for listeners anywhere to really feel into this because it's not easy. Learning to trust the process is one of the ways. Like when you're going into the dark valley, you kind of think, this is where it's going to end. Like, and I can't let myself go there because how am I going to get out of it? That's a really scary place to be. And I, as a therapist, I might even suggest that there's not a single person on this planet who hasn't had a brief thinking, I would rather not be here. This is too hard. So first of all, trusting that that's not the end. It's hardly ever the end, although obviously suicide is on the rise, especially for men. So this is another reason that we don't want to not speak about this, because we want to normalize speaking about the darkness. Otherwise, people go into a fit of shame, they are silenced, and they suffer alone, and then they do kill themselves. We're not hiding from this. It's real. So normalizing talking about it is another thing. So trusting the process, talking about it, and trying to connect with folks. Because we've, especially in the West, have moved into this idea of being alone and hyper-individual is transformative. Well, for you to be in that valley of darkness alone, we know now in the therapy world that it's actually the feeling of isolation that makes you want to end it. So we would suggest reconnecting. So trust the process, allow it to happen, and trust you will come out of it. This is never, hardly ever permanent, and try to reach out and articulate. It's the articulation, especially for men. To talk about your story is so courageous. Finding the words for your pain when you've been told your whole life that you oughtn't to feel any is an act of utter bravery. So that's another thing we're just trying to do, is normalize speaking about pain. It's 50% of our lives. Jen?
Yes, I all of that. And we are self-healing organisms. When we have a wound, our body knows how to heal. And you know, when we hurt ourselves, our hand goes to it, and we immediately start that healing process just in touching the wound. And then the body has its natural ability for self-healing. And in that same way, we too have a natural intelligence for healing, a wisdom. I call it my inner guru. And so part of coming through these dark nights of the soul or breakdowns is learning to trust that self-healing capacity, that knowing if I can heal my skin that way, I can also heal my wounds that way. And that if I'm listening and attuned to my inner world and I am bringing kindness as opposed to, you know, ignoring myself, if I'm paying attention to myself, that I'm activating just in paying attention to myself and having that conscious relationship with myself, I'm activating that intelligence. And I will trust that. And I trust that so much that even if I get drugged deep into the mud, which I do frequently get into the mud, that I'm going to be okay, that I can trust my capacity to be a self-healing organism on all levels. And that, for many of us, gets severed through trauma, through early childhood experience, that loss of trust for our inner world and our self-healing capacity. So one way to live in this wheel of transformation and not get swept up by these waves is really reconnecting with our inner capacity for healing.
There's a an anecdote from the teaching life of Chogyam Trungpa that comes up for me a lot, which is he was asked, what do you do if you find yourself in hell? And he said, I try to stay there. And the word try always interested me in that statement, because one of the things I've found with my own suffering is in the degree to which I volunteer to lean into it, it seems to become more capable of transformation. It seems like that's a common thread through a lot of forms of therapy, like exposure therapies work if you agree to the exposure, but not if you don't. So I'm wondering how much of trusting the process and trusting the self-healing capacity can be catalyzed or enhanced by voluntarily leaning into the experience of it.
Yeah, this is central to the transformative process, Layman, is allowing the feeling to be there, whatever feeling. So that's something we talk about quite often, is that wave of intensity. Doesn't matter in the end if it's pain or pleasure, actually. At some point, we witness both, and as well as feel them, not just witness and disassociate. So part of the transformative process is opening to more and more capacity to feel intensity. I mean, we'll notice day to day that we're always either moving towards something or away from something on a subliminal level. And that is a design at our sort of prehension level. It's below comprehension. It's the body itself is going, that's too hot, I'm going to move away, keeps me safe. That's really pleasurable, I want more of that, move towards. So second to second, we're navigating avoidance, sort of people call them allergies in our circles, or attraction, avoidance and attraction. So learning to navigate our lives, noticing the compulsions we're moving with, and it's usually towards pleasure and away from pain. So that's designed to keep us safe, but at some point we've got to realize that we're resisting pain. The more and more we resist pain, the more and more addicted we become to pleasure, to bypass pain. So if we notice that it's actually the intensity that transforms us, staying with the intensity doesn't actually matter in the end, because pain and pleasure both bring us to transformation. We have ecstatic states that just arrive. We open up to that intense pleasure. We have moments of crisis. And if we resist it and avoid it and run away and turn to pleasure as an avoidance mechanism, we're not letting that teach us to open up to that as well. So riding the waves of intensity right now in our world, sitting with it, letting it move right through us, not holding on to it, that's trauma when that gets frozen in the body. And as soon as we shut down pain, we also shut down pleasure. You can't do one without the other. So I think one of the things we can do most at this moment in our really suffering world is to open up, feel it all, notice how others are suffering, notice how you're suffering, breathe, open up, and it just passes through you. Yeah, what do you think about this, Jen?
Yeah, and also how counterintuitive it is to like walk towards pain. Like, who does that? Like, who's like, oh, I'm going to go towards that breakdown because I know there's something good in there for me. You know, no breakdown has, you know, really felt like that for me. Like, I'm just going to jump headlong into hell, you know, because I need this transformative experience. It really is. It's often very counterintuitive to move towards that, you know, and especially if we have trauma that has hooked us in certain places where we, you know, are seeking safety, and where we need to go is unsafe, right? To break that pattern is really going against our own nervous system, right? And again, this comes back to having that inner relationship with self so that we can be the inner moderator and regulator of our nervous system and say, let our nervous system literally know, yep, it's okay. This is going to be really painful, this experience. I lost my job, or, you know, my spouse is sick. This is going to be really painful. Okay, nervous system, I'm in here and I got you. and we're going to get through this, even though we're both terrified and you're wigging out inside, we're going to get through this together, right? So that kind of being that inner moderator and having that conscious relationship with self is essential, because so often that breakthrough is inside of a breakdown that is going to feel terrible. It's going to be painful. And that's why I think one of the things that we do in our podcast is we're intentional about telling a story in every show. And that's because we want to connect these stories of breakdowns and breakthroughs with actual lived on the ground experience. And that kind of storytelling also helps others know what it's like on the ground. And you're not alone in that. You know, we haven't certainly transcended any kind of fear, or, you know, we're not in any way enlightened or beyond suffering or any of that. And I feel like what makes our show unique is that we're really leaning into the messiness and complexity on the ground, where life is hard and suffering happens and there is pain. And so I'm really proud, as weird as that sounds, to be bringing forth something that feels really real.
Yeah, I'd like to also add that Jen and I are tracking transformation at scales, different scales, so the personal, the collective, the evolutionary. So noticing what happens in the body as transformation happens, it's messy and difficult. Translate that into what's going on in our world right now. Transformation is happening. It's messy and difficult. Evolution is messy and difficult. So learning how to cultivate resilience on the personal level, as well as resilience on the ecological level, is if you can see that as a pattern at scale, you can begin to understand how to navigate the difficulties right now. So if you're navigating your little body as well as your family life and noticing it's pain and pleasure. And so I'd like to just put into the space about the meaning crisis right now, which is what everybody's talking about. I noticed that we're jumping to a lot of solutions and trying to articulate things that haven't even been born yet. So to me, that's kind of trying to circumnavigate emergence itself, which is weird because we're supposed to be talking about emergence, but jumping to a meaning-making solution without feeling the anxiety and pain and trusting the process and letting things emerge. The universe knows what it's doing, you know, and there will be mutation and adaptation, and all the principles of emergence will apply. So, I'm a great believer in breathing, letting this difficulty be there, working with that, managing my nervous system, and trusting that this complexity is a birth. So if you've ever watched a woman give birth, it's messy, it's painful. You can't predict what will happen. So I don't feel that this is any different from watching a birth happen. Right.
Seems like there's a lot of nuanced skill that's necessary. Like with a birth process, there are a lot of intensities that you might initially want to refuse, but they are part of the natural process. But you can never be totally sure when those intensities might indicate that something's going wrong and rupturing the process. So when we think about transformational intensities and say, well, yes, they could be positive, they could be negative, but how do we tell? How do we develop skill to tell when something is in the range of intensity that we could open and adapt to, and when that intensity suggests something that might overload or break us?
Yeah, you and I have spoken about this before, Layman, about the beautiful masculine container that we need, as well as the flow and the allowing. So to me, it's always both. You know, it's the paradox. We absolutely need that left brain application right now of being sensible. Let's make some sense of this. Let's try and track the patterns. Let's anticipate. Let's problem solve. And balancing that with, okay, we'll do what we can minute to minute. We will be practical and sensible and jump to action. as well as allowing whatever is wanting to emerge and honoring the uncertainty. So yeah, it's always both as far as I'm concerned, Layman. And that's what we call the yin and the yang, you know, the flow as well as the container. We need the stability as well as the energy, the movement. Chen?
Yeah, I would agree. And I would also add that we, going back to that idea of trusting the intelligence that has flowed from the beginning of time is expressing through us. And so the more we can lean into that and say, yep, that same intelligence that holds everything since the Big Bang is within me, is operating within me, then, you know, we don't have to, it's not all on our shoulders. Yeah. Right? A lot of transformation, you know, there's not, I think it's, as much as it's hands-on, it's also hands-off at the same time, right? It's touching without touching, you know, it's the side eye and connection at the same time, right? So I think in our podcast, we really try to lean into that, you know, both and, you know, the complexity. It's never one way or the other. I'm both informing transformation and informed by transformation at the same time. And all of that requires just a very nimble relationship within yourself, that can move through experiences that are difficult and challenging in a way that is tapping into that intelligence that you have within, you know. And so our whole podcast is just trying to normalize that process and not trying to say it's this or that. It's really a messy, complicated process. And we're just trying to take it little bites at a time in ways that are translating big ideas into small packages that anybody would benefit from wherever they are in that field of transformation.
When people have gone through a transformation, there's a temptation and sometimes a service to try to help others transform. And when the transformation you've gone through seemed like maybe it was a breakdown, maybe it was overwhelming, maybe it was too intense, then there might be a temptation to think, it's okay for me to break other people down to help them have breakthroughs and transform. And it's a messy process, so it's okay if I create messy results. How do you two think about the ethics around trying to facilitate transformation in others, you know, keeping in mind that it's going to be messy and it's going to sometimes look like breakdown, but that can't be used as cover to unskillfully cause people to break down.
I'll just start by saying, so if you're giving birth, there's a number of people you can turn to. You can go to a birth doula. Your neighbor can help you cut the umbilical cord. Maybe if it's bit more intense, you need your GP, and if it's seriously intense, you need your gynecologist. So to me, any birthing, which transformation is, if there's blood, sweat, and tears, choose your facilitator really carefully. If you're going through a very dark night of the soul, choose somebody who's been properly trained. You know, you can go have coffee with your best friend. And I'm really suggesting men do this more and more. We really need to find each other. And because women tend to do this naturally, and that's why they're a little bit more resilient. We have each other. If you're feeling this is requiring more skilled facilitation, really reach out and find somebody who's properly trained. There's deep lack of ethics if you're going through something almost unmanageable and you're relying on your best friend to help you. That's not fair on anybody. What do you think, Jane?
Yes, I think that there's real danger in thinking that you can force somebody to transform, and that a lot of my work and writing and platform is devoted to reminding people of their own power and their own truth, as opposed to promoting, you know, my position or my truth, and helping people remember their own gifts and So that doesn't mean that I'm there saying, you know, this is how your transformation should look, or this is the right way to transform. I'm not interested in that at all. And I think that there are some, you know, serious ethical issues with believing that you can guide anybody through a dark night of the soul. At the same time, like Sally is mentioning, we need support and we need each other. And we feel like Sally and I and you, Layman, we're like lighthouses, right? We are information. We're giving a steady supply of sober quality information for people who are out there in their own experience. And but I don't see myself as a healer or, you know, somebody, a teacher even. I'm just sharing my knowledge and my experience in a way that hopefully is helpful. I do mentor a small group of people, but that isn't even, you know, it's really more about just constantly pointing people towards their power and towards the reliance on their own inner maps, as opposed to trying to create a map for people, because I think that can cause more problems and more confusion. And we're pretty clear about that, Sally and I. We never wanted to go into this trying to say, well, we know the way through transformation. If you just do, you know, A to B and follow our little handy guide, you'll get through transformation too. It's just not like that. And so and that comes from our own inner trust of our own experience, right? That is something that comes up through us trusting our own experience and our own. We know that we have what it takes to be self-healers. And therefore, that is extended to all people. We trust that they too have their own inner knowledge and inner wisdom that will guide them. And so we're just constantly pointing them people back to, and at the same time, holding, you know, supportive space for anybody who needs it. It's a mix. It's a magical mix of both being there and not being there.
Sally, I heard you use an interesting phrase in one of the podcasts, which was that transformation is a holographic, three-dimensional shift in the structures of consciousness. What do you mean by holographic, and what are the three dimensions?
Oh my God, Layman, you ask the most provocative questions. Now I'm on the spot. It's because I'm a pattern observer. So three directions is very reductive. So let me just, there's the ascending, which is developmental, the descending, feeling the body. But I think there's a sort of an X and a Y axis, but there's also a Z axis, which is you and your unique trajectory through life. So trying to put that into a little spiral dynamics map is tricky. We know this is at least three dimensions, probably five, seven. It's also energetic. We don't even know karmically there's a dimension. There's so basically we're just unfolding memory. And the memory is held in the DNA. It's held, you know, epigenetically as well through interaction with our context. There's inherited memory. There's family dynamics. There's, you know, context that we interact with every single day, the nurture, nature. So each trajectory is so unique, and that's overlooked in a lot of our liminal context, just because it's complex to talk about and we love efficient language and pretty pictures. Nothing wrong with that. It really helps us understand. The pretty pictures help us understand. It gives us a gestalt, and we forget that we're visual learners as well as oral. And so I learn a lot by looking at a flattened 2D map. But then I've got to remember that I've got to translate that onto all axes, and that it's living. It's an energetic process. It's not conceptual. I love to use my brain and look at it conceptually and flatten it, because, okay, now I've got deeper a gestalt in my mind that I can digest this very complex journey. But actually, then you've got to go live it, and that's at least three-dimensional, and it includes blood, sweat, and tears, and pain and pleasure.
Yes, and that's how we're creating meaning, right? We're going back to the meaning crisis. You know, if we're hungry for meaning, and you know, when we can create meaning on the ground of transformation the best we can, knowing it too is fleeting. As the field of transformation is transforming, the meaning transforms, right? So the deeper we can be on the ground of transformation, creating meaning, sense making on the ground, all of that is so much more enriched when we are participating with that consciously.
I'm thinking about my refrigerator, because when Sally, you mentioned the visual thing, I have this tendency to forget things I can't see. I take the crispers out of my fridge because if there's something in there, it'll just rot. I'll never look in it because I don't immediately see it. But when I was thinking about fridges, then I also thought about the way things spoil after a while in the fridge. That we have a tendency as human beings to say we've got some meaning. And if there's a meaning crisis, let's just double down on this meaning, what we've got. But if meaning is something that goes bad after a while, even if it's in the fridge, then the solution to the meaning crisis has to be transformation. It has to be constantly getting some new meaning somewhere, because it may wear out. It may go bad after a while.
There's an eating process, a metabolizing, right? You got to eat that stuff in the refrigerator, otherwise it's going to go bad, right? And you have to digest it and metabolize it and restock the fridge.
Yeah, what I've loved about this little research journey that we're doing together, Layman, is understanding that transformation as a concept shows up in every single discipline. From physics to biology to psychology to education. So what we're loving doing is noticing that every field of discipline has approached change as a concept and tried to understand it, but from their lens. So, you know, like a water can change from ice to liquid to steam, for example. Like every single discipline has tried to literally put words to this process of change. Psychology is the one that kind of notices how we resist it. And so that's been a new unfolding. People in the East have looked at it for 3,000 years as a phenomenon. So change is ubiquitous as a phenomenon. It's literally the only thing that is unchangeable. And in the East, they've looked at impermanence for a long time. This is amazing. So how we work with the change is the trick. Are we going to resist it, or are we going to work with it? Are we actually going to enhance it and facilitate it? That's the final stage, is how can I actually induce it if I want to? If I want to go the whole way in one lifetime before I start declining, which hardly anybody speaks about in our liminal waves, is actually this is a temporary process, because eventually you stop transforming. It doesn't matter how hard you try. Actually, you go back to your parts and then to the void. So it's almost like a wave from the void through an emergence process back down to a emergence process. So honoring that orange stage is probably the middle peak in our midlife, where we're fully embodying all our skills and success. And maybe we've only got the 80 years. Maybe we could only really get to whatever you want to call it, turquoise, whatever, when you start being again. So whether we label it with colors or make it linear or rhizomatic or a spiral, let's just be practical and notice there's a life. We come into midlife, we're at our peak, and we start to decline. And that is change. How do we work with that?
I believe in decline in general, but not for Dali.
Not for saying that.
I've been watching a lot of stuff by the stand-up comedian Neil Brennan lately. And to Sally's point there, he has an interesting riff on 180-year problems. There's things you just can't solve in 90 years. There's dimensions of transformation that just won't be worked out by a mortal being in that period of time. And that's a fascinating and liberating thing to think about ourselves. We have a vast amount of potential transformation, but we don't have to pressure ourselves to be able to undergo every possible transformation and solve every possible problem.
Yeah, so Jen and I look a little bit at the different ways we transform. One is hormonally. It'll happen without your conscious participation. You know, I've watched my kids get born, go through puberty, heading towards midlife. I watch myself declining through changes in hormones. And so it's going to happen despite us. So there's an underlying biological determinant. You can go through pain and suffering and pleasure. We spoke about that. That's number two. You can go through curricula that are deliberately designed to help you transform. So education has really been helpful with that. Practices, you can join a spiritual community. So you go into a container designed for your transformation. Super helpful. That's number three. Number four is one I propose is creativity as an actual act of emergence and creating culture. So to me, there's at least four ways. There's probably more, but Jen and I are just going to cover those pretty much.
And also, there are bleeps and blips in that ordinary journey of transformation that are unexpected, right? There's illnesses that come in at different times in life, and so if you look at that trajectory of transformation, it's certainly not it's a bumpy road, and we all take different turns and patterns. You know, some people don't get a full 80 years of life, and don't have or are have get an illness in their 20s that by their 30s they're totally disabled, right? So that transformation arc is different for all of us, and I think it's important that we recognize that no matter what our span of our arc of transformation is, whether we have 20 years or 50 years or 80 years, that the life that we live is transformative, not just for ourselves, but also for generations back and generations forward. You know, how we live our lives. You know, we talk about intergenerational healing, and in indigenous cultures, there's the belief that our lives are lived seven generations back and seven generations forward, right? So even if we have an unusual trajectory in our own lives, we still can impact fractally the past and the future. And I think that's really exciting. You know, I, as someone who's kind of always lived one foot in life and one foot in death because of physical illness, I know that whatever life I have, whatever time I have on this earth, I the intergenerational healing that I've done in my family lines is significant, and that the impact that I'm making now will have a reverberation into the resonance into the future too. And that's another dimension of transformation that we hope to really kind of normalize, right? That we're not just living for ourselves, we're living for other generations as well.
Yeah, this is part of that holographic question you asked, Layman, is it's temporal, spatial, as well as embodied.
Yes.
What about something like left and right, something like an axis between restoration and transformation, right? Both are processes of change. Both arrive back at a place that isn't necessarily the same as where it started. But a lot of people are focused on a change to secure something or to bring back what seemed to be there before. If my roof gets broken, there's a transformation whereby I try to reestablish my roof. But we're in a lot of communities where people talk for the most part about emergence and novelty and the production of something we've never seen before. And I feel like that's very alienating to people whose hearts strongly value healing and transformation in terms of restoring structures they're already familiar with, even though that restoration will never be a return. It will always be some form of advancement. But how do you both think about restoration versus transformation?
Yeah, so now we're getting into the numbers thing that is inherent to our culture. So, in the West, we're fairly one and zero, fairly binary, either or. So let's just look at Hindu culture, for example. They work in threes, the three gunas, as they're they've called them the energies that sustain manifestation. They call them the gunas. And those have archetypes. So there's Brahman, who's the creator, and Shiva, who's the destroyer. So Eros and entropy. They have a third, Vishnu, who's the sustainer. So I love that trilogy or trinity personally, you know, and in Middle Eastern culture, we have the trinity. So, you know, and they have energetic capacities, God, Son, and Holy Spirit. So they have different qualities. And if we want to see that as just gorgeous metaphors, which I love metaphors. It's a lovely way to imagine how manifestation is sustained. It's part of the tripartite. There is sustaining and restorative.
I would say that there are a lot of people who are really freaked out by transformation and are resistant to transformation. Transformation feels like a threat to an identity structure that is tightly held. And you see that in, you know, politics and in society. We see people who are really threatened by change. And I think we need to hold space. We certainly do on our podcast, and I certainly do in my heart, for those who are entrenched in those identity structures that feel very threatened by change. And, you know, this is where, you know, in my view, metamodernism comes in, because we have to be able to have conversations between symbolic universes with people that are afraid of transformation in ways that don't turn people off and don't freak people out and don't scare people and can invite them along the ride, even if they just really want things to kind of settle down and be restored to what some semblance of that they think is, you know, normal. Or even though we know that transformation is always happening, there are ways to speak to different populations who are afraid of transformation and afraid of change in ways that are non-threatening. And I think that our job as translators is to do that in graceful ways. And I'm all certainly always interested in having conversations. Mostly, I mean, the people that are into transformation, you know, we're kind of singing to the choir, right? I am interested in touching the people who are really afraid of change and really afraid of, you know, of those boundary lines where their identity might shake a little bit, and being a supporter of them in that process of shifting identities. So I think we all have a comfortability level with transformation. I love it. I'm interested in it. I enjoy it. But we also recognize that not everybody is in that space, and it feels threatening to a lot of people.
Yeah, I'd love to add to that Jen, I'm so glad you mentioned that. I think some of the metamodern project has to have the Vishnu quality. So what does that mean? As we reconstruct, that means bringing the best of the pre-modern and the modern forward. That is the Vishnu quality, is don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. We need that stability. There are so many beautiful remnants of truth that we can't just throw away. That's the meaning crisis, is when we lose hope. Well, we've got beautiful, beautiful gifts from the past that we need to inter-include as we rebuild. So that's the Vishnu. There's Shiva and Brahman in all of us, and Vishnu. So metamodern project is balancing those, I think.
Beautiful, yes.
So you've committed to doing an episode every 2 weeks for a year or something like that. And I'm curious what's in the back of your mind for a second season, if you had one. What do you think you'll not get to, but which is out on the horizon and you think is a fascinating thing to explore?
Layman, I'm one of those people that is just managing to hold the present together. This commitment to a podcast every 2 weeks for my aging brain is like, I'm It's beautiful, and I don't want to jump there. I trust it's going to emerge. Jen and I might even go into publishing. We don't know yet, but we will be publishing either visual things or textual things, or but how to bring creative objects that actually can find acupuncture points is our shared goal. How that one will unfold will reveal itself. I don't know what you think, Jen. And obviously want to include others. This isn't just Jen and I, but anyone who gets excited about this. Sorry, Jen.
Oh, yeah. No, I see us, you know, expanding on this, you know, perhaps in community in some way. I'm not really sure how that will look yet. But I think we will always probably be podcasting about something because I love it. I'm just having the time of my life. In this journey of podcasting, I'm learning and really just loving it. So I think we will, but we may not be about transformation, right? There's lots of big ideas that we can, you know, take on, you know, 1 year at a time and break down and translate, you know, we're interested in speaking to people on the ground, people in ordinary life who may not be naturally inclined to listen to a podcast about transformation, but they just listened in and hey, there's some really cool stuff in there that, you know, that's where we see ourselves in our work going and working together going because we want to provide practical tools for living on the ground of a difficult life. That is where both of our hearts are. And that is the that's the access point that will lead us forward going from here.
And I think the way we've structured it is to let it unfold, and because we, Jen and I, authentically trust evolution and emergence. But what we would like to include is real stories, beautiful citations. There's so many gorgeous thinkers that we want to include, but also absolutely grounded research. So that's the Vishnu, Brahma, and Shiva right there. We're going to have those as our tripod. So that's including both hemispheres, objective, subjective, and just trying to be the bridge.
If I shave and get a blonde wig, can I come on an episode?
Yes. You don't even have to shave. You may have to have some pompous grass behind you, but...
That's doable. That's doable. this has been fantastic. Thanks for giving us a little tour through part of what you two are working on. I think it's an exciting podcast. And from what I've heard so far, the amount of richness that's going to unfold over 26 episodes could be extraordinary. I'm very happy that you're doing this project. And I'm very happy that you've joined me today for a little while. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Layman. We're really touched that you included us. Thank you.
Thanks, Layman. Thanks, Layman. Thanks, Sally.